Chapter 3 The lion strode through the halls of hell. Across his path grim shadows fell, of many a moving, nameless shape, monsters with dripping jaws agape. The darkness shuddered with scream and yell when the lion stalked through the halls of hell. King Conan tested the ring in the wall and the chain that bound him. His limbs were free, but he knew that his shackles were beyond even his iron strength. The links of the chain were thick as his thumb and were fastened to a band of steel about his waist, a band as broad as his hand and half an inch thick. The sheer weight of his shackles would have slain a lesser man with exhaustion. The locks that held band and chain were massive affairs that a sledgehammer could hardly have dented. As for the ring, evidently it went clear through the wall and was clinched on the other side. Conan cursed, and panic surged through him as he glared into the darkness that pressed against the half-circle of light. All of the superstitious dread of the barbarian slept in his soul, untouched by civilized logic. His primitive imagination peopled the subterranean darkness with grisly shapes. Besides, his reason told him that he had not been placed there merely for confinement. His captors had no reason to spare him. He had been placed in these pits for a definite doom. He cursed himself for his refusal of their offer, even while his stubborn manhood revolted at the thought, and he knew that were he taken forth and given another chance, his reply would be the same. He would not sell his subjects to the butcher. And yet it had been with no thought of anyone's gain but his own that he had seized the kingdom originally. Thus subtly does the instinct of sovereign responsibility enter even a red-handed plunderer sometimes. Conan thought of Tsotha's last abominable threat and groaned in sick fury, knowing it was no idle boast. Men and women were to the wizard no more than the writhing insect is to the scientist. Soft white hands that had caressed him, red lips that had been pressed to his, dainty white bosoms that had quivered to his hot, fierce kisses to be stripped of their delicate skin, white as ivory and pink as young petals. From Conan's lips there burst a yell so frightful and inhuman in its mad fury that a listener would have stared in horror to know that it came from a human throat. The shuddering echoes made him start and brought back his own situation vividly to the king. He glared fearsomely at the outer gloom and thought of the grisly tales he had heard of Tsotha's necromantic cruelty, and it was with an icy sensation down his spine that he realized that these must be the very halls of horror named in shuddering legendry. The tunnels and dungeons wherein Tsotha performed horrible experiments with beings, human, bestial, and, it was whispered, demonic, tampering blasphemously with the naked basic elements of life itself. Rumor said that the mad poet Rinaldo had visited these pits and been shown horrors by the wizard, and that the nameless monstrosities of which he hinted in his awful poem, The Song of the Pit, were no mere fantasies of a disordered brain. That brain had crashed to dust beneath Conan's battle-axe on the night the king had fought for his life with the assassins the mad rhymer had led into the betrayed palace, but the shuddersome words of that grisly song still rang in the king's ears as he stood there in his chains. Even with the thought, the Cimmerian was frozen by a soft rustling sound, blood freezing in its implication. He tensed in an attitude of listening, painful in its intensity. An icy hand stroked his spine. It was the unmistakable sound of pliant scales slithering softly over stone. Cold sweat beaded his skin as beyond the ring of dim light he saw a vague and colossal form, awful even in its indistinctiveness. It reared upright, swaying slightly, and yellow eyes burned icily on him from the shadows. Slowly a huge, hideous, wedge-shaped head took form before his dilated eyes, and from the darkness oozed in flowing, scaly coils the ultimate horror of reptilian development. It was a snake that dwarfed all Conan's previous ideas of snakes. 80 feet it stretched from its pointed tail to its triangular head, which was bigger than that of a horse. In the dim light its scales glistened coldly, white as hoarfrost. Surely this reptile was one born and grown in darkness, yet its eyes were full of evil and sure sight. It looped its titan coils in front of the captive, and the great head on the arching neck swayed a matter of inches from his face. Its forked tongue almost brushed his lips as it darted in and out, and its fetid odor made his senses reel with nausea. The great yellow eyes burned into his, and Conan gave back the glare of a trapped wolf. He fought against the mad impulse to grasp the great arching neck in his tearing hands. Strong beyond the comprehension of civilized man, he had broken the neck of a python in a fiendish battle on the Stygian coast in his corsair days. But this reptile was venomous. He saw the great fangs, a foot long, curved like scimitars. From them dripped a colorless liquid that he instinctively knew was death. He might conceivably crush that wedge-shaped skull with a desperate clenched fist, but he knew that at the first hint of movement, the monster would strike like lightning. It was not because of any logical reasoning process that Conan remained motionless, since reason might have told him, since he was doomed anyway, to goad the snake into striking and get it over with. It was the blind, black instinct of self-preservation that held him rigid as a statue blasted out of iron. Now the great barrel reared up, and the head was poised high above his own as the monster investigated the torch. A drop of venom fell on his naked thigh, and the feel of it was like a white-hot dagger driven into his flesh. Red jets of agony shot through Conan's brain, and yet he held himself immovable. Not by the twitching of a muscle or the flicker of an eyelash did he betray the pain of the hurt that left a scar that he bore to the day of his death. The serpent swayed above him, as if seeking to ascertain whether there were in truth life in this figure which stood so deathlike still. Then suddenly, unexpectedly, the outer door, all but invisible in the shadows, clanged stridently. The serpent, suspicious as all its kind, whipped about with a quickness incredible for its bulk and vanished with a long-drawn slithering down the corridor. The door swung open and remained open. The grill was withdrawn and a huge, dark figure was framed in the glow of torches outside. The figure glided in, pulling the grill partly to behind it, leaving the bolt poised. As it moved into the light of the torch over Conan's head, the king saw that it was a gigantic black man. Stark naked, bearing in one hand a huge sword, and in the other a bunch of keys. The black spoke in a seacoast dialect, and Conan replied. He had learned the jargon while a corsair on the coasts of Kush.
"Long have I wished to meet you, Amra."
The black gave Conan the name Amra, the lion, by which the Sumerian had been known to the Kushites in his piratical days. The slave's skull split in an animal-like grin, showing white tusks, but his eyes glinted redly in the torchlight.
"I have dared much for this meeting. Look, the keys to your chains. I stole them from Shukeli. What will you give me for them?"
He dangled the keys in front of Conan's eyes.
10,000 gold lunas,
answered the king quickly, new hope surging fiercely in his breast.
"Not enough,"
cried the black, a ferocious exultation shining on his ebon countenance.
"Not enough for the risks I take. Tsotha's pets might come out of the dark and eat me, and if Shukeli finds out I stole his keys, he'll hang me up by my... Well, what will you give me?"
15,000 lunas and a palace in Poitain, offered the king.
The black yelled and stamped in a frenzy of barbaric gratification.
"More,"
he cried.
"Offer me more. What will you give me?"
"You black dog!"
A red mist of fury swept across Conan's eyes.
"Were I free, I'd give you a broken back. Did Shukeli send you here to mock me?"
"Shukeli knows nothing of my coming, white man,"
answered the black, craning his thick neck to peer into Conan's savage eyes.
"I know you from of old. Since the days when I was a chief among a free people before the Stygians took me and sold me into the north. Do you not remember the sack of Abombi, when your sea-wolves swarmed in? Before the palace of King Ajaga, you slew a chief, and a chief fled from you. It was my brother who died. It was I who fled. I demand of you a blood price, Amra."
"Free me, and I'll pay you your weight in gold pieces,"
growled Conan. The red eyes glittered. The white teeth flashed wolfishly in the torchlight.
"Aye, you white dog, you are like all your race, but to a black man, gold can never pay for blood. The price I ask is your head."
The last word was a maniacal shriek that sent the echoes shivering. Conan tensed, unconsciously straining against his shackles in his abhorrence of dying like a sheep. Then he was frozen by a greater horror. Over the black's shoulder, he saw a vague, horrific form swaying in the darkness.
"Tsotha will never know,"
laughed the black fiendishly, too engrossed in his gloating triumph to take heed of anything else, too drunk with hate to know that death swayed behind his shoulder.
He will not come into the vaults until the demons have torn your bones from their chains. I will have your head, Amra.
He braced his knotted legs like ebon columns and swung up the massive sword in both hands, his great black muscles rolling and cracking in the torchlight. And at that instant, the titanic shadow behind him darted down and out, and the wedge-shaped head smote with an impact that re-echoed down the tunnels. Not a sound came from the thick, blubbery lips that flew wide in fleeting agony. With the thud of the stroke, Conan saw life go out with the suddenness of a candle blown out. The blow knocked the great black body clear across the corridor, and horribly the gigantic, sinuous shape whipped around it in glistening coils that hid it from view, and the snap and splintering of bones came plainly to Conan's ears. Then something made his heart leap madly. The sword and the keys had flown from the black's hands to crash and jangle on the stone, and the keys lay almost at the king's feet. He tried to bend to them, but the chain was too short. Almost suffocated by the mad pounding of his heart, he slipped one foot from its sandal and gripped them with his toes. Drawing his foot up, he grasped them fiercely, barely stifling a yell of ferocious exultation that rose instinctively to his lips. An instant's fumbling with the huge locks, and he was free. He caught up the fallen sword and glared about. Only empty darkness met his eyes, into which the serpent had dragged a mangled, tattered object that only faintly resembled a human body. Conan turned to the open door. A few quick strides brought him to the threshold. A squeal of high-pitched laughter shrilled through the vaults, and the grill shot home under his very fingers. The bolt crashed down. Through the bars peered a face like a fiendishly mocking carven gargoyle, Shukeli the eunuch, who had followed his stolen keys. Surely he did not, in his gloating, see the sword in the prisoner's hand. With a terrible curse, Conan struck as a cobra strikes. The great blade hissed between the bars, and Shukeli's laughter broke in a death scream. The fat eunuch bent at the middle, as if bowing to his killer, and crumpled like tallow, his pudgy hands clutching vainly at his spilling entrails. Conan snarled in vicious satisfaction, but he was still a prisoner. His keys were futile against the bolt, which could only be worked from the outside. His experienced touch told him the bars were as hard as the sword. An attempt to hew his way to freedom would only splinter his one weapon. Yet he found dents on those adamantine bars, like the marks of incredible fangs, and he wondered with an involuntary shudder what nameless monsters had so terribly assailed the barriers. Regardless, there was but one thing for him to do, and that was to seek some other outlet. Taking the torch from the niche, he set off down the corridor, sword in hand. He saw no sign of the serpent or its victim, only a great smear of blood on the stone floor. Darkness stalked on noiseless feet about him, scarcely driven back by his flickering torch. On either hand, he saw dark openings, but he kept to the main corridor, watching the floor ahead of him carefully, lest he fall into some pit. And suddenly he heard the sound of a woman, weeping piteously. Another of Tsotha's victims, he thought, cursing the wizard anew, and turning aside, followed the sound down a smaller tunnel, dank and damp. The weeping grew nearer as he advanced, and lifting his torch he made out a vague shape in the shadows. Stepping closer, he halted in sudden horror at the amorphic bulk which sprawled before him. Its unstable outlines somewhat suggested an octopus, but its malformed tentacles were too short for its size, and its substance was a quaking jelly-like stuff which made him physically sick to look at. From among this loathsome gelid mass reared up a frog-like head, and he was frozen with nauseated horror to realize that the sound of weeping was coming from those obscene, blubbery lips. The noise changed to an abominable high-pitched tittering as the great unstable eyes of the monstrosity rested on him, and it hitched its quaking bulk toward him. He backed away and fled up the tunnel, not trusting his sword. The creature might be composed of terrestrial matter, but it shook his very soul to look upon it, and he doubted the power of man-made weapons to harm it. For a short distance he heard it flopping and floundering after him, screaming with horrible laughter. The unmistakably human note in its mirth almost staggered his reason. It was exactly such laughter as he had heard bubble obscenely from the fat lips of the salacious women of Shadazar, City of Wickedness, when captive girls were stripped naked on the public auction block. By what hellish arts had Tsotha brought this unnatural being into life? Conan felt vaguely that he had looked upon blasphemy against the eternal laws of nature. He ran toward the main corridor. but before he reached it, he crossed a sort of small square chamber where two tunnels crossed. As he reached this chamber, he was flashingly aware of some small squat bulk on the floor ahead of him. Before he could check his flight or swerve aside, his foot struck something yielding that squalled shrilly, and he was precipitated headlong, the torch flying from his hand and being extinguished as it struck the stone floor. Half-stunned by his fall, Conan rose and groped in the darkness. His sense of direction was confused, and he was unable to decide in which direction lay the main corridor. He did not look for the torch, as he had no means of rekindling it. His groping hands found the openings of the tunnels, and he chose one at random. How long he traversed it in utter darkness he never knew, but suddenly his barbarian's instinct of near peril halted him short. He had the same feeling he had had when standing on the brink of great precipices in the darkness. Dropping to all fours, he edged forward, and presently his outflung hand encountered the edge of a well, into which the tunnel floor dropped abruptly. As far down as he could reach, the sides fell away sheerly, dank and slimy to his touch. He stretched out an arm in the darkness and could barely touch the opposite edge with the point of his sword. He could leap across it then, but there was no point in that. He had taken the wrong tunnel, and the main corridor lay somewhere behind him. Even as he thought this, he felt a faint movement of air. A shadowy wind rising from the well stirred his black mane. Conan's skin crawled. He tried to tell himself that this well connected somehow with the outer world, but his instincts told him it was a thing unnatural. He was not merely inside the hill, he was below it, far below the level of the city street. How then could an outer wind find its way into the pits and blow up from below? A faint throbbing pulsed on that ghostly wind like drums beating far, far below. A strong shudder shook the king of Aquilonia. He rose to his feet and backed away, and as he did, something floated up out of the well. What it was, Conan did not know. He could see nothing in the darkness, but he distinctly felt a presence, an invisible, intangible intelligence which hovered malignly near him. Turning, he fled the way he had come. Far ahead, he saw a tiny red spark. He headed for it, and long before he thought to have reached it, he caromed headlong into a solid wall and saw the spark at his feet. It was his torch, the flame extinguished, but the end a glowing coal. Carefully, he took it and blew upon it, fanning it to flame again. He gave a sigh as the tiny blaze leaped up. He was back in the corridor where the tunnels crossed, and his sense of direction came back. He located the tunnel by which he had left the main corridor, and even as he started toward it, his torch flame flickered wildly as if blown upon by unseen lips. Again he felt a presence, and he lifted his torch, glaring about. He saw nothing, yet he sensed, somehow, an invisible bodiless thing that hovered in the air, dripping slimily and mouthing obscenities that he could not hear, but was in some instinctive way aware of. He swung viciously with his sword, and it felt as if he were cleaving cobwebs. A cold horror shook him then, and he fled down the tunnel, feeling a foul burning breath on his naked back as he ran. But when he came out into the broad corridor, he was no longer aware of any presence, visible or invisible. Down it he went, momentarily expecting fanged and taloned fiends to leap at him from the darkness. The tunnels were not silent. From the bowels of the earth in all directions came sounds that did not belong in a sane world. There were titterings, squealings of demoniac mirth, long, shuddering howls, and once the unmistakable squalling laughter of a hyena ended awfully in human words of shrieking blasphemy. He heard the pad of stealthy feet, and in the mouths of the tunnels caught glimpses of shadowy forms, monstrous and abnormal in outline. It was as if he had wandered into hell, a hell of Tzotzalanti's making. But the shadowy things did not come into the great corridor, though he distinctly heard the greedy sucking in of slavering lips and felt the burning glare of hungry eyes, and presently he knew why. A slithering sound behind him electrified him, and he leaped to the darkness of a nearby tunnel, shaking out his torch. Down the corridor he heard the great serpent crawling, sluggish from its recent grisly meal. From his very side something whimpered in fear and slunk away in the darkness. Evidently the main corridor was the great snake's hunting ground, and the other monsters gave it room. To Conan, the serpent was the least horror of them all. He almost felt a kinship with it when he remembered the weeping, tittering obscenity and the dripping, mouthing thing that came out of the well. At least it was of earthly matter, It was a crawling death, but it threatened only physical extinction, whereas these other horrors menaced mind and soul as well. After it had passed on down the corridor, he followed at what he hoped was a safe distance, blowing his torch into flame again. He had not gone far when he heard a low moan that seemed to emanate from the black entrance of a tunnel nearby. Caution warned him on, but curiosity drove him to the tunnel, holding high the torch that was now little more than a stump. He was braced for the sight of anything, yet what he saw was what he had least expected. He was looking into a broad cell, and a space of this was caged off with closely set bars extending from floor to ceiling, set firmly in the stone. Within these bars lay a figure, which, as he approached, he saw was either a man or the exact likeness of a man, twined and bound about with the tendrils of a thick vine which seemed to grow through the solid stone of the floor. It was covered with strangely pointed leaves and crimson blossoms, not the satiny red of natural petals, but a livid, unnatural crimson, like a perversity of flower life. Its clinging, pliant branches wound around the man's naked body and limbs, seeming to caress his shrinking flesh with lustful, avid kisses. One great blossom hovered exactly over his mouth. A low, bestial moaning drooled from the loose lips. The head rolled as if in unbearable agony, and the eyes looked full at Conan, but there was no light of intelligence in them. They were blank, glassy, the eyes of an idiot. Now the great crimson blossom dipped and pressed its petals over the writhing limbs. The limbs of the wretch twisted in anguish. The tendrils of the plant quivered as if in ecstasy, vibrating their full, snaky lengths. Waves of changing hues surged over them. Their color grew deeper, more venomous. Conan did not understand what he saw, but he knew that he looked on horror of some kind. Man or demon, the suffering of the captive touched Conan's wayward and impulsive heart. He sought for entrance and found a grill-like door in the bars, fastened with a heavy lock, for which he found a key among the keys he carried, and entered. Instantly the petals of the livid blossoms spread like the hood of a cobra. The tendrils reared menacingly, and the whole plant shook and swayed toward him. Here was no blind growth of natural vegetation. Conan sensed a malignant intelligence. The plant could see him, and he felt its hate emanate from it in almost tangible waves. Stepping warily nearer, he marked the root stem, a repulsively supple stalk thicker than his thigh, and even as the long tendrils arched toward him with a rattle of leaves and hiss, he swung his sword and cut through the stem with a single stroke. Instantly, the wretch in its clutches was thrown violently aside as the great vine lashed and knotted like a beheaded serpent, rolling into a huge irregular ball. The tendrils thrashed and writhed, the leaves shook and rattled like castanets, and the petals opened and closed convulsively. Then the whole length straightened out limply, the vivid colors paled and dimmed. A reeking white liquid oozed from the severed stump. Conan stared, spellbound. Then a sound brought him round, sword lifted. The freed man was on his feet, surveying him. Conan gaped in wonder. No longer were the eyes in the worn face expressionless. Dark and meditative, they were alive with intelligence, and the expression of imbecility had dropped from the face like a mask. The head was narrow and well-formed, with a high, splendid forehead. The whole build of the man was aristocratic, evident no less in his tall, slender frame than in his small, trim feet and hands. His first words were strange and startling. "What year is this?" he asked, speaking Kothic.
"Today is the 10th day of the month Yuluk of the year of the gazelle," answered Conan.
"Yagkulan Ishtar!" murmured the stranger. 10 years!"
He drew a hand across his brow, shaking his head as if to clear his brain of cobwebs.
"All is dim yet. After a 10-year emptiness, the mind cannot be expected to begin functioning clearly at once. Who are you?"
"Conan, once of Sumeria, now king of Aquilonia."
The other's eyes showed surprise.
"Indeed, and Nemedides?"
"I strangled him on his throne the night I took the royal city," answered Conan.
A certain naivete in the king's reply twitched the stranger's lips.
"Pardon, your majesty, I should have thanked you for the service you have done me. I am like a man woken suddenly from a sleep deeper than death and shot with nightmares of agony more fierce than hell, but I understand that you delivered me. Tell me, why did you cut the stem of the plant Yoska instead of tearing it up by its roots?"
"Because I learned long ago to avoid touching with my flesh that which I do not understand," answered the Sumerian.
"Well for you," said the stranger. Had you been able to tear it up, you might have found things clinging to the roots against which not even your sword would prevail. Yothka's roots are set in hell.
But who are you? Demanded Conan.
Men call me Peleus.
What? Cried the king. Peleus the sorcerer, Sothlanti's rival, who vanished from the earth 10 years ago?
Not entirely from the earth, answered Peleus with a wry smile. Sotha preferred to keep me alive in shackles more grim than rusted iron. He pinned me in here with this devil flower whose seed drifted down through the black cosmos from Yag the Accursed and found fertile field only in the maggot-writhing corruption that seethes on the floors of hell. I could not remember my sorcery and the words and symbols of my power, with that cursed thing gripping me and drinking my soul with its loathsome caresses. It sucked the contents of my mind day and night, leaving my brain as empty as a broken wine jug. 10 years. Ishtar, preserve us!
Conan found no reply, but stood holding the stump of the torch and trailing his great sword. Surely the man was mad, yet there was no madness in the dark eyes that rested so calmly on him.
Tell me, is the black wizard in Khorshemish? But no, you need not reply. My powers begin to wake, and I sense in your mind a great battle and a king trapped by treachery. And I see Tsothlanti riding hard for Tibor with Strabonus and the king of Ophir. So much the better. My art is too frail from the long slumber to face Tsotha yet. I need time to recruit my strength, to assemble my powers. Let us go forth from these pits.
Conan jangled his keys discouragedly.
The grill to the outer door is made fast by a bolt which can be worked only from the outside. Is there no other exit from these tunnels?
Only one, which neither of us would care to use, seeing that it goes down and not up,
laughed Peleus.
But no matter. Let us see to the grill.
He moved toward the corridor with uncertain steps as of long unused limbs, which gradually became more sure. As he followed, Conan remarked uneasily,
There is a cursed big snake creeping about this tunnel. Let us be wary lest we step into his mouth.
I remember him of old, answered Peleus grimly. The more as I was forced to watch while 10 of my acolytes were fed to him. He is Sata, the old one, chiefest of Tsotha's pets.
Did Tsotha dig these pits for no other reason than to house his cursed monstrosities? Asked Conan.
He did not dig them. When the city was founded 3,000 years ago, there were ruins of an earlier city on and about this hill. King Kossus V, the founder, built his palace on the hill, and digging cellars beneath it came upon a walled-up doorway which he broke into and discovered the pits, which were about as we see them now. But his grand vizier came to such a grisly end in them that Kossus, in a fright, walled up the entrance again. He said the vizier fell into a well. But he had the cellars filled in, and later abandoned the palace itself, and built himself another in the suburbs, from which he fled in a panic on discovering some black mold scattered on the marble floor of his palace one morning. He then departed with his whole court to the eastern corner of the kingdom and built a new city. The palace on the hill was not used, and fell into ruins. When Akutho I revived the lost glories of Khorshemish, he built a fortress there. It remained for Tsothalanti to rear the scarlet citadel and open the way to the pits again. Whatever fate overtook the Grand Vizier of Kossus, Tsotha avoided it. He fell into no well, though he did descend into a well he found, and came out with a strange expression which has not since left his eyes. I have seen that well, too, but I do not care to seek in it for wisdom. I am a sorcerer and older than men reckon, but I am human. As for Tsotha, men say that a dancing girl of Shadazar slept too near the pre-human ruins on Dagoth Hill and woke in the grip of a black demon. From that unholy union was spawned an accursed hybrid men called Tsothalanti.
Conan cried out sharply and recoiled, thrusting his companion back. Before them rose the great shimmering white form of Sata, an ageless hate in his eyes. Conan tensed himself for one mad berserker onslaught, to thrust the glowing faggot into that fiendish countenance and throw his life into the ripping sword stroke. But the snake was not looking at him. It was glaring over his shoulder at the man called Peleus, who stood with his arms folded, smiling. And in the great cold yellow eyes, slowly the hate died out in a glitter of pure fear, the only time Conan ever saw such an expression in a reptile's eyes. With a swirling rush like the sweep of a strong wind, the great snake was gone.
What did he see to frighten him?
asked Conan, eyeing his companion uneasily.
"The scaled people see what escapes the mortal eye,"
answered Peleus cryptically.
"You see my fleshly guise. He saw my naked soul."
An icy trickle disturbed Conan's spine, and he wondered if, after all, Peleus were a man, or merely another demon of the pits in a mask of humanity. He contemplated the advisability of driving his sword through his companion's back without further hesitation, but while he pondered, they came to the steel grill, etched blackly in the torches beyond, and the body of Shukeli still slumped against the bars in a curdled welter of crimson. Peleus laughed, and his laugh was not pleasant to hear.
"By the ivory hips of Ishtar, who is our doorman? Lo, it is no less than the noble Shukeli, who hanged my young men by their feet and skinned them with squeals of laughter. Do you sleep, Shukeli? Why do you lie so stiffly with your fat belly sunk in like a dressed pig's?"
"He is dead," muttered Conan, ill at ease to hear these wild words.
"Dead or alive," laughed Peleus, "he shall open the door for us."
He clapped his hands sharply and cried,
"Rise, Shukeli, rise from hell and rise from the bloody floor and open the door for your masters. Rise, I say."
An awful groan reverberated through the vaults. Conan's hair stood on end and he felt clammy sweat bead his hide, for the body of Shukeli stirred and moved with infantile gropings of the fat hands. The laughter of Peleus was merciless as a flint hatchet as the form of the eunuch reeled upright, clutching at the bars of the grill. Conan, glaring at him, felt his blood turn to ice and the marrow of his bones to water, for Shukeli's wide-open eyes were glassy and empty, and from the great gash in his belly his entrails hung limply to the floor. The eunuch's feet stumbled among his entrails as he worked the bolt, moving like a brainless automaton. When he had first stirred, Conan had thought that by some incredible chance the eunuch was alive. But the man was dead, had been dead for hours. Peleus sauntered through the opened grill, and Conan crowded through behind him, sweat pouring from his body, shrinking away from the awful shape that slumped on the sagging legs against the grate it held open. Peleus passed on without a backward glance, and Conan followed him in the grip of nightmare and nausea. He had not taken half a dozen strides when a sodden thud brought him around. Shukeli's corpse lay limply at the foot of the grill.
"His task is done, and hell gapes for him again,"
remarked Peleus pleasantly, politely affecting not to notice the strong shudder which shook Conan's mighty frame. He led the way up the long stairs and through the brass skull-crowned door at the top. Conan gripped his sword, expecting a rush of slaves, but silence gripped the citadel. They passed through the black corridor and came out into that in which the censers swung, billowing forth their everlasting incense. Still they saw no one.
"The slaves and soldiers are quartered in another part of the citadel," remarked Peleus. "Tonight, their master being away, they doubtless lie drunk on wine or lotus juice."
Conan glanced through an arched, golden-silled window that led out upon a broad balcony and swore in surprise to see the dark blue star-flecked sky. It had been shortly after sunrise when he was thrown into the pits. Now it was past midnight. He could scarcely realize he had been so long underground. He was suddenly aware of thirst and a ravenous appetite. Peleus led the way into a gold-domed chamber, floored with silver, its lapis lazuli walls pierced by the fretted arches of many doors. With a sigh, Peleus sank onto a silken divan.
"Golden silks again," he sighed. "Sotha affects to be above the pleasures of the flesh, but he is half-devil. I am human, despite my black arts. I love ease and good cheer. That's how Sotha trapped me. He caught me helpless with drink. Wine is a curse. By the ivory bosom of Ishtar, even as I speak of it, the traitor is here. Friend, please pour me a goblet. Hold, I forgot that you are a king. I will pour."
"The devil with that," growled Conan, filling a crystal goblet and proffering it to Peleus.
Then, lifting the jug, he drank deeply from the mouth, echoing Peleus' sigh of satisfaction.
"The dog knows good wine,"
said Conan, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand.
"But by Crom, Peleus, are we to sit here until his soldiers awake and cut our throats?"
"No fear," answered Peleus. "Would you like to see how fortune holds with Strabonus?"
Blue fire burned in Conan's eyes, and he gripped his sword until his knuckles showed blue.
"Oh, to be at sword points with him," he rumbled.
Peleus lifted a great shimmering globe from an ebony table.
Tsotha's crystal, a childish toy, but useful when there is lack of time for higher science. Look in, Your Majesty.
He laid it on the table before Conan's eyes. The king looked into cloudy depths which deepened and expanded. Slowly images crystallized out of mist and shadows. He was looking on a familiar landscape. Broad plains ran to a wide, winding river, beyond which the level lands ran up quickly into a maze of low hills. On the northern bank of the river stood a walled town, guarded by a moat connected at each end with the river.
"By Crom!" ejaculated Conan. "It's Shamar! The dogs besiege it!"
The invaders had crossed the river. Their pavilions stood in the narrow plain between the city and the hills. Their warriors swarmed about the walls, their mail gleaming palely under the moon. Arrows and stones rained on them from the towers, and they staggered back but came on again. Even as Conan cursed, the scene changed. Tall spires and gleaming domes stood up in the mist, and he looked down on his own capital of Tamar, where all was confusion. He saw the steel-clad knights of Poitain, his staunchest supporters, riding out of the gate, hooted and hissed by the multitude which swarmed the streets. He saw looting and rioting, and men-at-arms whose shields bore the insignia of Pelia, manning the towers and swaggering through the markets. Over all, like a phantasmal mirage, he saw the dark, triumphant face of Prince Arpello of Pelia. The images faded.
"So," raved Conan, "my people turn on me the moment my back is turned."
"Not entirely," broke in Peleus. "They have heard you are dead. There is no one to protect them from outer enemies in civil war, they think. Naturally, they turn to the strongest noble to avoid the horrors of anarchy. They do not trust the Poitanians, remembering former wars, but Arpello is on hand, and the strongest prince of the central provinces."
"When I come to Aquilonia again, he will be a headless corpse rotting on Traitor's Common."
Conan ground his teeth.
"Yet before you can reach your capital," reminded Peleus, "Strabonus may be there before you. At least his riders will be ravaging your kingdom."
"True."
Conan paced the chamber like a caged lion.
"With the fastest horse, I could not reach Shamar before midday. Even there I could do no good except to die with the people when the town falls, as fall it will in a few days at most. From Shamar to Tamar is 5 days' ride, even if you kill your horses on the road. Before I could reach my capital and raise an army, Strabonus would be hammering at the gates, because raising an army is going to be hell. All my damnable nobles will have scattered to their own cursed fiefs at the word of my death. And since the people have driven out Tresero of Poitain, there's none to keep Arpello's greedy hands off the crown, and the crown treasure. He'll hand the country over to Strabonus in exchange for a mock throne, and as soon as Strabonus' back is turned, he'll stir up revolt. But the nobles won't support him, and it will only give Strabonus excuse for annexing the kingdom openly. Oh, Crom, Ymir, and Set, if I but had wings to fly like lightning to Tamar!"
Peleus, who sat tapping the jade tabletop with his fingernails, halted suddenly and rose as with a definite purpose, beckoning Conan to follow. The king complied, sunk in moody thoughts, and Peleus led the way out of the chamber and up a flight of marble gold-worked stairs that led out on the pinnacle of the citadel, the roof of the tallest tower. It was night, and a strong wind was blowing through the star-filled sky, stirring Conan's black mane. Far below them twinkled the lights of Khorshemish, seemingly farther away than the stars above them. Peleus seemed withdrawn and aloof here, one in cold, unhuman greatness with the company of the stars.
"There are creatures," said Peleus, "not alone of earth and sky, but of air and the far reaches of the skies as well, dwelling apart, unguessed of men. Yet to him who holds the master words and signs and knowledge underlying all, they are not malignant nor inaccessible. Watch, and fear not."
He lifted his hands to the skies and sounded a long, weird call that seemed to shudder endlessly out into space, dwindling and fading, yet never dying out, only receding further and further into some unreckoned cosmos. In the silence that followed, Conan heard a sudden beat of wings in the stars, and recoiled as a huge, bat-like creature alighted beside him. He saw its great calm eyes regarding him in the starlight. He saw the 40-foot spread of its giant wings, and he saw that it was neither bat nor bird.
"Mount and ride," said Peleus. "By dawn it will bring you to Tamar."
"By Crom," muttered Conan. Is this all a nightmare from which I shall presently awaken in my palace at Tamar? Well, what of you? I would not leave you alone among your enemies.
Be at peace regarding me, answered Peleus. At dawn the people of Korshemesh will know they have a new master. Doubt not what the gods have sent you. I will meet you in the plain by Shamar.
Doubtfully Conan clambered upon the ridged back, gripping the arched neck, still convinced that he was in the grip of a fantastic nightmare. With a great rush and thunder of titan wings, the creature took the air, and the king grew dizzy as he saw the lights of the city dwindle far below him.